this year, Israeli media reported that Israeli authorities recruited the Jewish National Fund to secretly buy Palestinian land for settlers. Palestinians warned that the move by the Jewish National Fund is another proof for Israel's attempts to illegally seize more land in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds by forced expulsion of real owners. They say, however, that they will never back down and they will continue resisting these Israeli plans. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
In the limelight.
Deforestation in Brazil's Amazon rainforest surged to its highest annual level in a decade over the past year, with researchers warning that the accelerated destruction of the critical carbon sink is imperiling the ability to keep planetary heating below the Paris Climate Agreement's 1.5 degrees Celsius target. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Out of Control, Brazilian Amazon Deforestation Hits Highest Level in a Decade. Stay tuned for more. Encouraged by President Jair Bolsonaro, deforestation in Brazil's Amazon rainforest surged to its highest annual level in a decade over the past year, with researchers warning that the accelerated destruction of the critical carbon sink is imperiling the ability to keep planetary heating below the Paris Climate Agreement's 1.5 degrees Celsius target. Imazon, a Brazilian research institute whose mission is to promote conservation and sustainable development, reported recently that from August 2020 to July 2021, 10,476 square kilometers of Amazon rainforest were destroyed, a 57% increase over the previous 12-month period. In July alone, 2,095 kilometers were deforested, 80% more than in the same month in 2020, said Imazon, adding, "This area is larger than the city of São Paulo." According to the institute, the northeastern state of Pará suffered the most severe deforestation in July, losing 771 square kilometers, an area about the size of Austin, Texas. Additionally, 7 out of the 10 indigenous territories most affected by forest destruction during the 12-month period were located in the state. Deforestation is still out of control, Amazon researcher Carlos Souza told The Guardian, adding, "Brazil is going against a global climate agenda that is seeking to urgently reduce greenhouse gas emissions." Amazon said that, "At this rate, we will not be able to keep global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, a target defined in the Paris Agreement. Often called the lungs of the planet for its role in keeping CO2 emissions in check, the massive 2.1 million square mile Amazon rainforest is one of the most biodiverse places on the planet, boasting some 3 million plant and animal species." Nearly a million indigenous people from over 300 tribes, including some who have never had any contact with the outside world, also call the Amazon home, However, since taking office in 2019, Bolsonaro has strongly encouraged economic development, including logging, mining, expansion of agricultural activity, and the construction of a major highway and a dam in the region. Despite the devastation caused by these and other activities, the Bolsonaro administration has vowed to accelerate Amazon exploitation, claiming the region is unproductive and desert-like. The administration has also slashed funding for federal agencies tasked with catching and prosecuting illegal farmers and loggers who are responsible for around 90% of Amazon deforestation, according to Greenpeace Brazil. The new Amazon data was released 2 days after the publication of a study in the journal Global Change Biology, showing that the impact of Amazon deforestation on rainfall amounts can be up to 4 times greater than estimated by scientists. The researchers concluded that vegetation loss could result in a 55% to 70% reduction in annual precipitation. This study's results strongly indicated that current estimates of precipitation effects of land cover changes in the Amazon are underestimated, affecting not just the Amazon basin itself, but also the surrounding basins such as the La Plata and Orinoco basins, its researchers said. Amazon says there are many things people can do to help combat Amazon deforestation, including eliminating or limiting beef consumption, buying wood products made from trees in replanted forests, and voting for politicians who prioritize an environmental agenda over economic developments.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanted whisper.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And our guest speaker, as always, Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program again.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Well, the concept and the topic that we are going to delve into related to the Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Sistani is mourning. And that is the mourning for Imam Hussein and Muharram. And this is actually a good platform for me and the whole crew here from the RIB English Radio to express our condolences to everybody who's listening to us, to our dear audiences. And inshallah, we hope that this program would come to good use. Let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani and then we'll be back.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men.
He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Tawbi, we are talking about the laws related to mourning and lamentation for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, or peace be upon him. Let me ask you this question. How should people mourn Muharram in general and Ashura in particular?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, as I said in the previous episode, the commemoration of Ashura on during Muharram actually serves to remind us of the sacrifice of the family of the Prophet, and it is highly recommended to commemorate this event, this important event, which took place in the Islamic history. Now, the question that you asked deals with how we should mourn Ashura, how should we actually go about mourning and commemorating this important event, given the fact that commemorating this event is highly recommended.
Mm-hmm.
From a legal perspective or from a Sharia point of view,
mm-hmm.
is recommended. Of course, different people commemorate the event of Ashura in different ways. Okay, there's not a fixed pattern, a fixed way of commemorating this event. For example, if we look at Indians, they have their own way of commemorating this event, and of course the Iranians, the Persians commemorate this important event in their own way. The Iraqis and the Lebanese, of course, they have, and there's no objection whatsoever when it comes to the way people mourn and commemorate this important event. And of course, what is important is during this Ashura, as I said in the previous episode, is when it comes to the concept of mourning during Ashura, and the concept is actually to respect the symbols of religion and remember the suffering of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam and his family, his companions, and of course, and also to remember his uprising, which was aimed at defending Islam,
mm-hmm.
and of course, and preventing the destruction of the religion by the Bani Umayyad family, the Bani
dynasty.
Umayyad dynasty.
Yes.
And of course, when it comes to how we should narrate, of course, we must understand that it is really important to narrate the story of Ashura. That's the main point, because narrating the story of the sacrifices, narrating the story of the uprising which took place on the day of Ashura is very important. It's mm-hmm. important in the first place.
Yes.
So we have to give more time and more space to the lecturers, to those scholars who are knowledgeable, who are learned, of course, and not to those people who just simply come with poems and eulogies, okay?
Yes.
Because we must protect and preserve the traditional way of commemorating the event of Ashura. And it, probably if we adopt new ways of commemorating, it may not serve that purpose. The mm-hmm. purpose is to narrate the story, to remind the people of the sacrifices made by Imam Hussein and his companions and his family members.
Yes, of course. Okay, if you agree, let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our discussion and laws related to mourning according to Ayatollah Sistani.
Sure.
I work in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you. Who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces. Who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing. To me.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We are talking about the laws related to azadari and mourning for Imam Hussein during Muharram, according to Ayatollah Sistani. Sheikh Javid, you know, lots of people during these sad days and nights,
yes.
In fact, go to the mosque and commemorate
yeah.
This month. And in fact, they do or perform some special rituals. For example, they beat their chest. All right.
Yeah.
And they also cry. But is it permissible to weep, wail, cry loudly and mm. also beat not only your chest but your heads and face
mm-hmm.
in fact you know, in line with mourning for Imam Hussein, peace be upon him?
Well, when it comes to crying and wailing and also beating your head and face in mourning, according to Ayatollah Sistani, of course, there's no problem, there's no scar or whatsoever. It is permissible.
Mm-hmm.
It is permissible, but you know, we do understand that wailing and scratching your face or beating your head when a relative dies or when someone who you love
mm-hmm.
dies, but he is an ordinary person, okay,
yes.
is not is discouraged, and in some cases it's haram. For example, if a woman scratches his face in public places and wails, it is not permissible. But when it comes to mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, Ayatollah Sistani says that it is permissible to cry, it's permissible to wail and beat your head, and also do anything which is considered in common view as an act of azadari.
As long as it is not harmful to the body?
Yeah, as long as it's not harmful. Of course, when it comes to harm and the damage you might cause to yourself,
mm-hmm.
you must see whether it is considered in common view or damage or harm or not, okay?
Mm-hmm,
yeah, if it is considered substantial harm, you know, scratching, beating your head, it doesn't inflict any harm, it doesn't damage your brain or anything, okay? And of course, it is permissible when it comes to azadari for Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. But if you are supposed to hurt yourself or harm yourself, and the harm is substantial, it is considerable, you should not do it because it's not permissible to harm oneself, to inflict damage or harm upon oneself.
Yes, and it's not limited to mourning, actually.
It's
right?
not limited to mourning, of course. Because there's a verse in the Quran which says, "La tulqu anfusukum bi'idikum ila tahluka," which means that you should not cast yourself with your own hands into
right.
destruction.
Right.
But of course, when it comes to azadari, it is not considered hitting yourself is not considered casting yourself into destruction or throwing yourself
mm-hmm.
into destruction.
Okay, Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to jog or run at a steady, gentle pace in mourning processions, which are taken out into the streets to commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him?
Well, this is just a custom which is prevalent in
yes.
Iraq, in some Arab countries.
Yes, I've seen it myself in the shrine of Imam Hussein,
yeah,
right on the day of Ashura,
yeah.
myself, yes.
And this is just, it's a pretty acceptable custom. Carried out by Iraqis, so there is nothing wrong with it. Okay.
Yes.
Of course, Shia Muslims in India, Shia Muslims in Pakistan, in Iran, do not jog. They do not run with the flags in their hands. Okay, around the shrine of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. But Iraqis do. They jog. They run with a gentle pace, and of course, there is no harm, no problem in jogging and running in as a sign of commemorating and mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam.
So there's no problem with
there's
that.
No problem.
Okay. How about any objection to people holding up chandeliers or flags ahead of the mourning processions?
There is no problem. It is still, of course, chandeliers and, of course, flags are carried by Shia Muslims almost
yes.
in every
mm-hmm.
in every Muslim country.
Yes.
And it, of course, it's very common. There's no problem. None of the religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Sistani, has objected to
mm-hmm.
this.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Once again, I use this opportunity to express our heartfelt condolences to our dear audiences, and may God accept all of our mourning and azadari for Imam Hussein and their pure household. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to risk to the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new land.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Witnesses the developments in Afghanistan following the chaos that ensued from the abrupt U.S. withdrawal from the country, questions are being raised about Washington's war on Afghanistan and its outcome. the Taliban swept through the country at a lightning speed and managed to take control of the capital, Kabul, in less than 2 weeks. Even the Pentagon officials expressed wonder at the rate at which provincial capitals across Afghanistan fell to the militants, as the U.S. intelligence services had estimated the Afghan capital would be isolated within 30 days and overtaken 2 months after. The harrowing scenes of chaos at the Kabul airport amid the evacuation of Western citizens and troops also drew criticism against how the foreign forces pulled out of the Central Asian country. Some observers are drawing parallels between the events in Afghanistan and the U.S. retreat from Vietnam Saigon after two decades of mindless violence in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The scenes were also reminiscent of Israel's humiliating defeat in southern Lebanon in the year 2000.
Yes, I think it's a valid comparison because both humiliating withdrawals came as a result of Western powers intervening militarily in states where they were not welcome. And they will continue to meddle militarily in the country. So I think one could say that national sovereignty and territorial integrity is not guaranteed for most of the countries of the world until finally the U.S. empire is brought down.
What do these historical events say about the U.S. and its ally Israel's influence in the West and Central Asia? The United States invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks in New York with the stated aim of fighting terrorism. It removed the Taliban from power and installed a pro-Western government in the country. Washington has also been training Afghan security forces over the years, providing more than $80 billion worth of funds to build up the Central Asian country's 300,000-strong army. It has also trained 22,000 commandos and special forces in Afghanistan to defend against security threats. However, the number of attacks in Afghanistan saw a sharp growth since Western troops were deployed to the country. Furthermore, the costly training of the soldiers turned out pointless as they quickly surrendered to the Taliban amid the militants' incursion.
The fact that the U.S. is losing around the world and that Israel is losing its grip in the Middle East is due to the fact that people are resisting in the countries of the world, and especially in the Middle East.
The drawdown of the U.S. forces from West and Central Asia can also have implications for Israel, Washington's closest ally in the region.
It's true that Israel's power relies 100% on the power of the U.S. empire. And if the U.S. empire continue, if people continue to resist successfully, and if the U.S. continues to weaken, then Israel's leaders might think about turning a new page. They might think about sharing the land with the Palestinian people, including all the refugees from around the world.
The events in Afghanistan in the past 2 weeks are going to be remembered in history books as yet another example of Western powers' failures after intervening in the affairs of countries where they are not welcome. The question is whether those actors will learn the lessons or if history will keep repeating itself.
Lately, the UN-affiliated Pan American Health Organization reported that COVID cases are accelerating in North America, driven primarily by a surge in southern and eastern United States and central Mexico. The spike is blamed on the highly infectious Delta variant of the virus. The organization stated that COVID cases in the United States are up by a third. The United States is currently the worst-hit nation in the world in terms of infections and fatalities. So, who is to blame for this situation? Last week, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick blamed the unvaccinated African-American community for the latest COVID surge. The Lieutenant Governor's remarks drew criticism as some called his assertion baseless. The latest data from the state of Texas Department of Health Services shows the highest coronavirus case rates are among whites and Hispanics, who make up over 70% of the state's cases, not the African-Americans. Meanwhile, African Americans are more prone to the COVID-19 as they are twice as likely to die compared to their white counterparts. For instance, in the capital, Washington, D.C., African Americans account for 76% of the COVID deaths, while they make up less than half of the population. In addition, they are less likely to get vaccinated amid the variant spreads. African Americans have received smaller shares of vaccinations compared to their shares of cases and the total population. Out of the 58% of people who had received at least one dose of the vaccine, nearly two-thirds are white and only 10% are African Americans. But COVID-19 is not the only problem they are facing. As the pandemic started last year, many working-class African Americans struggled with housing costs and faced eviction, as rent rates increased faster than their incomes. That's the best example of economic inequality in American society. Another issue that has plagued American society is racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group. Many African Americans are reluctant to receive COVID jabs. This unwillingness is the result of distrust that formed after centuries of injustice toward African American communities. Vaccine hesitancy among African Americans is rooted in the historical mistreatment of the community by the U.S. government and medical institutions. One of the most horrific chapters in U.S. history is the infamous Tuskegee experiment. In 1972, a report exposed that the U.S. Public Health Service had conducted a 40-year experiment at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama on hundreds of impoverished black men with syphilis. They were deliberately left untreated so doctors could study the disease. Many of the men died of syphilis and its complications. Some of their wives and babies were infected as well.
What was done cannot be undone, but we can end the silence. We can stop turning our heads away. We can look at you in the eye and finally say, on behalf of the American people, what the United States government did was shameful, and I am sorry.
The experiment added to the deep distrust many African Americans have toward the federal government.
Because this idea of brutality, colonial brutality, has persisted throughout the history here. I mean, I know that some people would like to talk about Tuskegee, the Tuskegee experiment that lasted for 40 years here in the United States of America from 1932 to 1972, where white people used African men as test studies for the development of syphilis in human beings. And so some people say that our distrust is, being African people's distrust is based on that kind of history. But again, African people all around the world have sense enough not to trust anything that the colonizer says is good for us, because nothing they've ever said is good for us has been.
Racism and injustice, unethical medical experiments, and slavery all have contributed to the distrust that was in making for centuries. Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, an ambitious $11 billion project that would transport natural gas from Russia directly to Germany by bypassing Ukraine. The project will double the existing Nord Stream pipeline running from Russia to Europe across the Baltic Sea and is a sustainable way to ensure European energy security. The Nord Stream 2 project is close to completion, yet it has for long caused tensions between Moscow and Washington. The United States sees the project as a potential threat, believing that it will increase Europe's dependence on Russian gas exports and isolate Ukraine. As a matter of fact, by bypassing Ukraine, Russia and the European Union could save the transit fees that make up to 3% of Ukraine's GDP. In addition, Washington worries that Moscow's success in transferring natural gas to Europe would undermine the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions in place against the country since 2014 due to the conflict in Ukraine.
On Friday, Washington slapped new sanctions on a ship and two entities involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project. At the same time, U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order allowing for sanctions to be imposed on certain Russian officials. Although this deepens the rift between the U.S. and Russia, it is unlikely to have much impact on the nearly completed energy project. The U.S. and Germany had struck an agreement when it came to Nord Stream 2. The Biden administration waived sanctions on the company overseeing the construction of the pipeline and its chief operating officer, yet it goes ahead with sanctioning Russian officials. It appears that the U.S. is still after sabotaging this project.
But basically, they're trying to look tough even though they're kind of surrendering, because it's clear that the Nord Stream will take place. Who is very much kind of stand to lose as a result of that is Ukraine, because, you know, Ukraine utilizing the oil pipeline, more or less 20% of their income depends on that. So Ukraine is going to lose money, and that's what the United States' interest is. They ask Germany to help. They don't want to pay themselves, so they push Germany to help Ukraine. But so that's the bottom line. But, you know, so they can sanction the Russians, but they more or less will have to agree with the Nord Stream to go on.
Britain and the U.S. both targeted seven Russians with sanctions and also issued a joint statement warning Russia over chemical weapons. The targeted Russian individuals are described as Russian security officials allegedly involved in a nerve attack on Navalny last year. This is while Moscow has denied any involvement in the incident. Washington separately imposed sanctions on another two men and four Russian institutes it said were involved in chemical weapons research or what it described as an assassination attempt against Navalny. Navalny was poisoned using a nerve agent. He was flown to Germany for medical treatment after falling ill in Siberia on August 20th last year. Though he survived, he was arrested in January when he returned to Russia. The U.S. has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the latest round of sanctions over Nord Stream 2 and the Navalny case, Russian Foreign Ministry condemned the measures as unilateral and illegitimate, vowing that Moscow's response to sanctions will be tough and appropriate.
The developments in Afghanistan have been making headlines for the past few days, following the chaos that ensued the abrupt U.S. troops withdrawal from the country. The Taliban's meteoric rise to power and pandemonium at the Kabul airport prompted criticisms against how the U.S. pulled out its troops and also the outcome of the 20-year war on Afghanistan. Western politicians were among those expressing regret over incidents in Afghanistan, with German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying it appeared that all the troops killed in the war had died in vain. But that's not the only bitter legacy of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. Russia's Security Council Secretary Nikolai Petrushev has said that Washington turned the Central Asian country into a global illicit drug laboratory in the past 20 years. In an interview, the Russian security chief noted that the production of opiates in Afghanistan have increased over 40-fold during the past two decades.
Well, obviously, a lot of this was being produced during the time that the United States and the NATO forces were active in Afghanistan. And there was really never a concerted effort. There were attempts every now and then, you know, to do destroy fields and to, you know, persuade the farmers to produce, you know, corn or wheat or something like that. But it was not very successful, and it was never really a concerted effort on the part of the authorities to do that.
The Russian official added that the war crippled Afghanistan's economy, throwing it back decades. The United United States has been training Afghan government forces for the past 20 years. Out of 300,000 Afghan troops, 22,000 have been commandos that Washington says have received special training. Despite that, the Taliban managed to sweep through the nation in a matter of days and seize the capital, Kabul, faster than anybody had anticipated. The rapid rate at which Afghan cities fell to the militant group also stunned Pentagon officials.
They had the training, the size, the capability to defend their country. This comes down to an issue of will and leadership. And no, I did not, nor did anyone else, see a collapse of an army that size in 11 days.
According to Russia's security chief, Nikolai Petrushev, the West was never able to train the army, police, and security services of Afghanistan, as the number of attacks in Afghanistan have increased significantly after foreign forces were deployed to the country.
The Taliban, during the course of the time the United States was so-called in charge in Afghanistan, and really they controlled only a small part of the country. They were never in control of the entire country. Much of this, much of the Taliban influence was still making itself felt in various parts, in especially in the region, some of the mountainous regions that often were inaccessible to large-scale military intervention. And the fact that that was an ongoing fight in which the Taliban were pitted against the official Afghani forces, then it seems reasonable that these would increase to the extent that they still felt themselves at war with a foreign power.
Petrushev added that the reported 40,000 civilian deaths since 2001 in Afghanistan has been understated, and that the figure doesn't include tens of thousands of Afghan troops that have been killed over the years. The Russian security official concluded that the staggering number of deaths is a result of the U.S. interference in the domestic affairs of other countries.
The Light.
The world's highest expressway has opened to traffic in China's Tibet Autonomous Region. It's nearly 300 kilometers long and has an average elevation of 4,500 meters. It connects the cities of Nachu and Lhasa, shortening the travel time from 6 to 3 hours. The road passes through many picturesque areas, such as snowy mountains, grasslands, and wetlands. The expressway is also environmentally friendly. Special passages have been devised for animals to get from one side of the freeway to the other. An architectural firm in Singapore has come up with a unique idea to deal with a country's constant warm temperatures. A hotel on the island's busy business district has been covered with more than 20 species of creeping plants to keep the place cooler. A layer of vegetation blankets the facade of the Red Tower, which is growing thicker with the passage of time. The plants reduce the ambient temperature by a combination of water evaporation and releasing cooler vapor. The architect says the tower is 10 to 20 degrees Celsius cooler than nearby buildings. The green facades also reduce harmful carbon emissions, which account for over 20% in a sprawling city.
The youngest panda at the U.S.'s Smith's Dorian Zoo, National Zoo that is, has turned one. Baby panda Xiao Qiji celebrates the milestone by eating a specially made fruitsicle cake with his mother, Mei Xiang, in Washington, D.C. Both pandas dug into their icy cake, an ideal treat in the hot and humid summers of the U.S. capital. Xiao has captured hearts and had many first-time experiences. Some of them include sliding and tumbling around in snow and recognizing his name, which translates to Little Miracle in English.
He was born during the pandemic, and given the age of his mother, we didn't think she'd have another cub. And the fact that we, not just that we had this miracle, but he has just been, he's given people moments of pure joy and pure happiness.
Zhao Qiji is a fourth surviving cub of Mei Xiang. Its older siblings now live in China under an agreement with the United States. Pandas have been reclassified from endangered to vulnerable thanks to reforestation to expand habitats in which the species can survive. There are an estimated 1,800 giant pandas in the wild.
The annual Buddha sculpture has been unveiled at the New York State Fair to the delight of eager spectators. The artwork was sponsored for the 53rd year by the American Dairy Association. It was carved out of 400 kilograms of Buddha and took 10 days to build. The sculpture is dedicated to the children who will be going back to their normal lives after the coronavirus pandemic is over. Once the fair ends, all of the butter will be broken down and turned into renewable energy. Switzerland is constructing its biggest alpine solar plant in an effort to secure renewable energy throughout the year. The 2.2 megawatt plant is expected to be completed by the end of 2021. The Mutzi site will include nearly 5,000 solar modules and produce around 3.3 million kilowatt hours of electricity. It will have the option of delivering half of its production during the winter when temperatures drop to sub-zero levels in Switzerland. The developers say the project makes more environmental than fiscal sense. Currently, the country gets less than 4% of its electricity from solar power. An eatery in Japan is giving disabled people a new lease on life by including them in its workforce. Dawn Cafe uses robotic staff controlled remotely by people who are handicapped. Around 50 people with mental and physical disabilities help run the cafe. The pilots come from all over Japan as well as overseas. The venue was established with support from major companies and crowdfunding. It has become more than just a place to eat for its customers.
Customers here are not exactly coming to this location just to meet the Orihime robots. They come here because of the people behind Orihime, and they will come back to see them again.
For Kentaro, Dawn Cafe has a very personal touch. In his childhood, he was left unable to go to school due to a period of bad health. Now he aspires to come up with ways to further the inclusion of disabled people in society. Crowds of visitors and conservationists have been delighted by the birth of a rare orangutan in the Spanish town of Fuengirola. The new residents of the safari park made its first public appearance 2 weeks after its birth. The baby, yet to be named, is the only one to be born in a European zoo over the past 12 months. The park has launched a program to conserve Bornean orangutans that are considered as a critically endangered species. Their population has declined by more than 50% over the past century. Dozens of baby turtles have made their way to the sea after an unexpected overnight hatch in Italy. Italian volunteers were surprised by track marks of the hatchlings from an unknown nest in Sicily. Some of the eggs hatched in the morning. An environmental group following the turtles' movement said that 74 hatchlings made it to the sea while 5 didn't. The reptiles are an endangered species of oceanic turtle that also live in the Mediterranean Sea. Their population has declined in recent years due to hunting, loss of beach nesting sites, over-harvesting of their eggs and being caught in fishing gear.
A Slovenian enthusiast has discovered a new cave in the Alpine country, which is staggering visitors by its awe-inspiring looks. Ludvik Husu, a 63-year-old cave explorer, has come across a cavern that runs 60 meters deep in the ground. It's located in the country's karst region, an area of land made up of limestone. Some 14,000 caves are buried under the green forest of Slovenia, hiding away breathtaking stalactite and stalagmite formations. The limestone region is so pristine and uncharted that the European Space Agency has used the caves to train astronauts.
Yeah, astronauts.
Astronauts also know that the karst world is exceptional, special in a similar way to how a space environment can be. It is an unknown environment where you do not know what to expect at your next step. They have been here to train for precisely that, how to help yourself in a dark area where you're not sure what's going on and everything is new. That's very good training for space, and they have been very pleased to be able to prepare for something they might find in space.
Over 150 species, some looking like alien creatures, have been discovered inside the cave systems. They include an ancient aquatic salamander called the little dragon that can live up to 100 years. The animal was previously considered living proof that dragons had once existed. Some cave systems in Slovenia stretch for tens of kilometers. They are so winding and deep that scientists say large parts of them remain undiscovered despite exploration efforts dating back hundreds of years.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
As the U.S. is experiencing its worst heat wave, Boston zookeepers are working extra hard to keep the animals cool to avoid overheating. Some get frozen treats, and some, like the yak, get a water hosing several times a day when the temperatures rise. The hardest part is cooling down animals belonging to cold climates, like the reindeer. Since reindeer don't like water, the hosing down is a big no. Instead, the poor animals sit in front of a desk fan all day to stay away from the heat. The birds have it a little easier as they spend most of their time in air-conditioned dens.
In Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift his function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device.
We don't know much about woolly mammoths that went extinct some 10,000 years ago, except their scanned references in archaeology books. Now scientists have discovered that the giant mammals could walk incredibly long distance. Scientists from the University of Alaska have concluded that a male mammoth named Kik covered enough ground in its 28-year lifespan to encircle the Earth twice. to come up with the data, paleontologists analyzed one of Kik's well-preserved tusks. They say the animal lived with a herd through its infancy and youth and then went on to live alone. Scientists hope they will learn more about mammoths by analyzing further data from Kik's remains.
Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain proved that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of Fatik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now a skillful artist in her workshop who designed colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite a tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing, and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together, and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive.
IRIB English Radio.